Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who was Aaron Burr, and what actions transformed him from a Revolutionary War hero and respected government leader to a political outcast accused of treason? While Burr is best remembered today as the man who shot and killed rival Alexander Hamilton in an 1804 duel, he was never even tried for Hamilton's murder. In fact, his most fervent and powerful enemy would prove to be Thomas Jefferson, under whom he served one term as vice president. During Jefferson's second term, Burr hatched a plan to seize territory from Spanish-held Mexico and Florida with hopes of convincing some American citizens to secede from Western territories and join his own federation. Attorney and author David O. Stewart tells this remarkable story in his new book, American Emperor, Aaron Burr's Challenge to Jefferson's America. David, welcome back to Think.
Thanks very much.
Aaron Burr was 20 years old when the American colonies declared their independence from Great Britain. What role did he play in the Revolutionary War?
Well, he was highly regarded soldier. Actually, even before the age of 20, while still in his teens, he had joined the Army before Boston. In 1775, he was on this terrible expedition up to Canada in that following winter. And this very young, very short and slight fellow from a somewhat privileged background turned out to be a terrific soldier. He was brave. He was tough. He made it through when stronger, bigger men didn't. And he rose very fast. He was a colonel by the age of 21, and he commanded a regiment at the Battle of Monmouth. He really was the men who served with him always held him in the highest regard. And I think it really was a molding experience for him. He really was always after that, had a military frame of mind and military attitudes.
After the war, though, he was just 25 years old. He built this illustrious career as an attorney and then a legislator in New York. What kind of political philosophies guided his decisions at that point?
Well, that's a trickier question than it ought to be. He was fond, as a lawyer, of the saying, things written remain, and he was always very leery of writing things down. So really, almost alone among the Founding Fathers, you cannot find much speculation or political analysis or thoughts about the Constitution from Aaron Burr. It made his contemporaries sort of nervous. One of the things Hamilton criticized about him, and he criticized a lot about Burr, was that he had no theory. Burr was a man of action, not a man of ideas. So he really believed in liberty. He fought for it. He believed in self-government. He had something of an aristocratic attitude, however. So, and it's very difficult to get too much beneath that.
Do you think that even in his early career, when he didn't want to write things down and talk about his own strategies and philosophies, do you think that that shows the seeds of a sort of clandestine tendency in him?
It's hard to resist that inference. And it's certainly, there was a sense of mystery to Burr, which his contemporaries wrote about. He seemed to imply secrets. He was a very urbane and gracious fellow and very well-mannered and witty. But he was always a bit reserved, and he did tend to imply secrets. And, you know, I think, in fact, he did keep a few secrets over time. He was a quite renowned ladies' man and was very discreet about that. So that certainly is one category of social secret that people would be a Twitter about, by and large. So it was part of his personality.
He does seem, even by modern standards, to have been quite a good father to his daughter.
Yes, he was remarkable. He had only one daughter from his marriage, and he had her educated and raised as any young man would have been. She was educated in Greek and Latin and natural philosophy and science, and was by many considered the best educated young woman in America. And his letters to her are doting. They're sometimes very demanding. He, you know, insisted that she write good letters and that she speak well and that she master her studies. But they're also incredibly affectionate and very charming. And there is some evidence that when he was an old man, he also raised two sons who were his illegitimate sons. So he had, you know, very ordinary and laudable personal qualities.
How effective was he as a senator?
It's difficult to say because the Senate wasn't doing a great deal in that era. They only sat 5 months a year, and the legislation was handled in secret. The Senate met in secret at the time, so it's difficult to trace any individual senator's contribution. It was known that he was particularly concerned about fostering development in the West. That was just in sort of Ohio and Kentucky and Tennessee at the time, and was viewed as a great friend of Tennessee in its quest for statehood, and had been engaged in some other matters involving the West. But, you know, he left the Senate after one term, and it doesn't seem that he left with great regret. It was not. It was something I think he valued doing, but I think he felt he'd done it enough.
This will be more important as we get further into this discussion, but it makes sense now to pause and say that the government back then, we should remind people, was quite small.
It was very small. You know, the army was a few thousand people, and the bureaucrats who worked for the government might have numbered 100. There were some tax collectors in different ports. And Congress was very small. We had, we started with 26 senators and about 60 congressmen. So it was a very different scale. You know, what government tried to do was very different. In fact, government tried to do relatively little.
So, David, early in his career, Aaron Burr had a relatively warm relationship with Alexander Hamilton. How did that begin to deteriorate?
It really frayed, and it's entirely possible that before then they were rivalrous at some level. But in the early 1790s, it really frays because Burr is elected to the Senate and defeats Hamilton's father-in-law, mm-hmm. Philip Schuyler. And that does seem to have been a moment when Hamilton decided he really didn't like Burr. But before then, they had, and even after that, they worked on law cases together. They certainly knew each other socially. They're in many ways doppelgangers, and there's a weirdness to it. They're both extraordinarily talented, gifted young lawyers. They're physically very similar, sort of short and slim, and military in their bearing. And they were traveling very much the same roads. So there was a sort of pairing of the two, which, of course, had a fairly ghastly end.
What kind of relationship did Aaron Burr have with Thomas Jefferson before they were president and vice president?
Jefferson claimed that he had never trusted Burr, and he claimed this after a point when it was clear that he certainly didn't trust Burr any longer. But if you take him at his word, he always was put off by Burr's obvious ambition, and Burr was clearly an ambitious man, and others found that he was too ambitious. And Burr, of course, which was his pattern, really never said what he thought of Jefferson in a way, in a written form. We do know that he generally thought that Jefferson was, frankly, sort of a coward. Jefferson had a bad episode in the Revolutionary War when he was thought to have run from British troops when he was governor of Virginia. As a personality, he was non-confrontational. And there is a general view you can see in Burr's conduct as much as anything that he doesn't really think Jefferson's a particularly tough or worthy opponent in some respects. It was a miscalculation of fairly epic proportions on Burr's part, but you do see that.
Jefferson, as I think everybody remembers, was a very proud Virginian, and Aaron Burr, of course, was born in New Jersey. Was there at that time a kind of cultural divide between North and South?
Very much, and I think that would have played some role. I mean, there were friends across those regions that were friendships formed in the founding era. You know, Jefferson famously ended up started with the friendship with John Adams from Massachusetts, and they went back and forth through their lives, but shared a high regard for each other. But there was a different worldview. Burr was from a commercial society. He was engaged in lawyering for merchants and for men of business. And Jefferson mistrusted all those people. He believed in the people of the land were the virtuous ones. His great close friends, of course, were largely plantation owners like him. So there certainly were very different worlds that they inhabited.
So how did Burr find himself with a shot at the presidency in 1800 when the leaders of the party had clearly intended for him all along to be vice president?
It really comes from the flaw in the Constitution. It had been written for the presidential elections on the assumption that we would just have wise men who would sit around and vote for the best candidates, and whoever came in first would be president, whoever came in second would be vice president. And they never anticipated parties. Mm-hmm. And parties quickly formed. And so in 1796, you had Adams running against Jefferson, basically. But in the election, in the Electoral College, Adams came in first and his opponent came in second, so his opponent became his vice president, which was pretty odd. And so in 1800, both parties realized that they had to have real discipline when they got into the Electoral College, and everybody had to vote their straight ticket, which meant that Jefferson and Burr ended up in a tie because all the 71 Republican electors voted for both of them. That threw the election into the House of Representatives, and when it got there, it turned out that the Federalists were in a position to tie up the election. They still had enough seats in the House. So they decided they prefer Burr. Sort of going back to your first question, Burr's philosophy was sufficiently indistinct, and he seemed to be somewhat more sympathetic to Federalist issues than Jefferson was. So the Federalists decided they would back Burr, and it resulted in 36 tied ballots in the House, a full week of voting, and a real constitutional crisis.
And finally, one guy basically turned in a blank ballot.
Well, it's not quite that easy. What happened is Burr wrote a letter from Albany and told the Federalists that they should stop voting for him, and a couple of congressmen changed their ballot. And Jefferson won on won by two states, so there was more of a flip than just one guy.
And so at that point, there was never going to be any reparation of that relationship between Jefferson and Burr.
It's hard to imagine how, but there certainly wasn't. Jefferson disliked conflict. They never sort of had it out. He actually continued to maintain civil relations with Burr, but politically he just cut Burr's throat. He wouldn't give him any patronage in New York, where Burr desperately needed it. He supported all of Burr's opponents in New York, cut the ground out from under him, and then dropped him from the ticket for the election of 1804.
Attorney and author David O. Stewart is with us. We're talking about his new book, American Emperor, Aaron Burr's Challenge to Jefferson's America. If you'd like to join us, we do have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is attorney and author David O. Stewart. His newest book is called American Emperor, Aaron Burr's Challenge to Jefferson's America. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So, David, Aaron Burr was not being invited to a lot of cabinet meetings, but he did preside over the Senate. Talk a little bit about how he was viewed there in that capacity.
Well, he was highly regarded as presiding officer of the Senate by both parties. He was an intelligent fellow, so he didn't commit blunders. He had a sense of dispatch in moving the business along, and he played it very fair. Through his career, he always found partisanship sort of ungentlemanly and not what should be done. It actually made both parties tend to mistrust him, but it is, frankly, the quality you want in a presiding officer. So he really was highly respected in the job. A couple of times, though, he failed to support the Jefferson and the Republican position in the Senate in a way that was bound to annoy Jefferson greatly. So his independence actually helped cement the bad relationship he had with Jefferson.
Do you sense that it was more personal for Jefferson than it was for Burr when Burr did not support Jefferson's positions?
I actually think in each instance prominent ones were the Judiciary Act in early in 1801, and then in 1802, and then the impeachment trial of Justice Samuel Chase of the Supreme Court. I genuinely think in both instances Burr was doing what he thought he should do. He was simply calling balls and strikes, playing the game the way it was supposed to be played as presiding officer, and was not trying to annoy Jefferson. So I do think it was, you know, the irritation level was much higher at the Jefferson end.
So interestingly, Burr seems to have maintained that sense of decorum when it came to his words about Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, on the other hand, was far less generous. What kinds of insults did he fire at Burr that finally led to this duel in 1804?
Well, he had always said that Burr was corrupt, that he had no political principles, and that Burr was dangerously ambitious and power mad. That was sort of standard. What happened when Burr ran for governor of New York in 1804 was Hamilton was quoted adding a phrase, "I have an opinion of this gentleman still more despicable." It's sort of not a phrase that reverberates for us, particularly in 2011. At the time, though, the term despicable implied sexual perversion. Hmm. And I think today such language would cause a lot of upset, and it did for Burr. He wrote a demand that Hamilton either retract the statement or explain it or meet him on a field of honor. And ultimately, Hamilton chose to duel.
Yeah, it is interesting that there was this sort of letter writing back and forth because, and pardon the pun here, it wasn't like Burr went off half-cocked and said, "That's it, meet me at noon." It took a while for them to get to this point.
Exactly. It took 3 weeks. And Burr's initial letter is all business, but it's not particularly insulting. And Hamilton's reply is, frankly, a little insulting, and it's certainly mealy-mouthed. And at that point, Burr does write a letter back saying, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, "I'm even angrier now than I was before." And things got out of hand. They did this letter writing through seconds, through their through friends, and the job of the friend was to try to make the duel go away and to get some reconciliation. And they did try, both of them. They drafted statements for Hamilton to adopt that might make Burr happy, and they were never able to come to any agreement, and so the duel went off.
We should note here that by this time, dueling was illegal in both New York and in New Jersey, where the shootout actually took place, but they remained relatively common. How often did they actually end in the death of one of the participants?
Less than half the time. probably no more than a quarter of the time. The pistols were not very reliable, and people were pretty nervous, I think.
Surely.
Yeah, so, you know, your aim isn't necessarily the best. And there were a lot of woundings. It was not uncommon, and I think, you know, men of honor might well aim for the leg, and there were a lot of woundings in the leg. But that clearly was not, or doesn't appear to have been, Burr's intention. Possibly he was aiming for the leg and missed, but he hit Hamilton right in the side.
And Hamilton clearly understood that duels could be deadly.
He had to. He had his son, his oldest boy, had died in a duel just 2 years before.
With the same set of pistols.
Yeah. Isn't that perverse?
Yeah.
I mean, why would you even keep those pistols? I would.
In case I might need these again, I don't want to, you know, put them in a garage sale or something.
Yeah. You just wouldn't want to have them around. Mm-hmm. But he brought them to the dueling place. And ironically, it was the same set of pistols Burr had used in a duel with Hamilton's brother-in-law some 5 years earlier. So, and those pistols are still in existence. I think the president of Chase Manhattan has them, or Morgan Chase. But, you know, there was no doubt that you were facing death, and that was part of the way that a gentleman showed his worth, was that he was willing to face death with calmness. And both of them at the duel, by the accounts of the survivors, did in fact behave exactly as they were supposed to.
You mentioned J.P. Morgan Chase. It's an interesting side note that Burr started the company that ultimately would become what we know as J.P. Morgan Chase today.
It is odd, and it was one of the episodes that caused people to mistrust him, because he actually got a corporate charter through the New York State Assembly to start a water company that would provide fresh water to Manhattan. And it never really did provide much water, but he had a provision in it that allowed that company to do other things as well, so he started a bank.
Hmm. Okay, back to the duel. We've left people hanging here, although everybody knows how it turned out. What can we know for sure, David, about who fired first and about what the two men's intentions might have been with regard to the death of their opponent?
Well, that's the real soup. There were three survivors, the 2 seconds and Burr, and they have different accounts. We do know that Hamilton said to a couple of friends and in written items that he left behind that he was going to throw away his shot. That was the phrase at the time for miss on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
When he got to the dueling ground that morning, though, he made a big fuss about sighting down his pistol and then saying that he needed to wear his glasses, and he pulled out his spectacles and put on his glasses. So either he had second thoughts about it, or he was going through this elaborate pantomime so as to intimidate Burr. I don't know. It is confusing that he acts in such an inconsistent fashion compared to what he said he was going to do. The moment of the shooting, Burr claimed that Hamilton shot first, and so did his second, and so did Burr's second. Hamilton's second claimed that Burr shot first, and that Hamilton's gun just went off as sort of an involuntary reflex after he'd been struck by the bullet. And that's a dispute that cannot be resolved.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Stephen on the line in Plano. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Chris. I used to work for Chase Manhattan Bank in New York, and I visited the pistols. They were on display up in the executive offices in the Chase Manhattan Tower in New York, downtown. And there was some discussion in those in the display that Hamilton had the pistols made to have a hair trigger, which apparently was not quite considered fair, and that he may have accidentally fired his pistol too soon and fired into the air. And that's why Burr was able to shoot him.
What do you think, David?
This is one of the wonderful disputes in history. The hair triggers were not discovered for 100 years or more afterwards. And descendants of Burr and descendants of Hamilton argue it with passion today as to who was flim-flamming who. And my conclusion was that neither of them was using the hair trigger, or certainly nobody got an unfair advantage from the hair trigger. You know, they had both handled those guns. Burr had handled them in the previous duel. They may well both have known about the hair trigger, but both of them were able to shoot. So it's clear that it didn't. It doesn't appear to me that there's a basis for saying there was an advantage one way or the other. Neither of the seconds thought so either.
Why was Burr never tried for Hamilton's death?
Duelists were not uncommonly indicted in this period and were occasionally prosecuted, but it was a very difficult case to win. And there, I didn't find any records of a duelist being convicted of murder. And the self-defense argument is pretty good because the other guy's got a gun and you're just shooting to defend yourself. Mm-hmm. So, and juries didn't really think dueling was really wrong. So New York never prosecuted him. And in fact, New York really didn't have jurisdiction to prosecute him. The duel happened in New Jersey. And in New Jersey, after about 4 or 5 years, I guess, they did finally quash the indictment.
And you've actually been to the site where this all went down.
As best I could. The true site was obliterated by railroad construction in the 19th century, but as close as you can get to it, I've been. I think it's actually where it was is where there's now an air vent from the Lincoln Tunnel on the Hudson River.
So Byrd had his sights on the governorship of New York. He lost that election. What kind of a blow was this to him to have had all this power and suddenly be out?
Well, he was such an ambitious fellow. He was a man of great talent. He knew it. And everybody around him thought he was marked for greatness. And at this point, after losing the vice presidency, he loses this election, and then he is indicted for murder after killing Hamilton. He knows that sort of conventional politics are not really available to him as a way to advance himself. So he still has this burning ambition to do something great. You know, in this era, there was a notion of fame, which Washington and Adams and Jefferson felt as well. And you wanted to achieve fame, and it wasn't sort of celebrityhood. It was a recognition of your quality, of your worth as a person. And Byrd wanted to achieve that, and that's why he began this outrageous Western expedition, basically to write his own new chapter in history and do something nobody else had ever dreamed of.
It's funny, these days a disgraced politician still can go in, you know, write a book or go into broadcasting or, you know, the lobby or something, but those options were not available.
Well, that's right. I'm not sure he would have had, I suppose he could have gone off and practiced law in New York. He did ultimately do that, but yes, you're right, there was no media, there was no way to cash in on your fame otherwise.
Okay, so let's talk about this plan he hatched. It sounds so crazy. Was it as crazy as it sounded?
Well, yes and no. Mm-hmm. Let me take all positions on that.
All right. That's what historians do.
Yeah, he reached an understanding with the head of the army, James Wilkinson, who's an extraordinarily rascally character.
Teddy Roosevelt said he was like the worst American in history.
He did, and it's hard to argue with because he was the head of our army. He was also a secret agent for Spain at the same time, and he was no great shakes as a general. He'd been court-martialed a number of times, although never convicted, and it was said of him that he had never lost an investigation or won a battle. But he and Burr came up with this notion of Burr was going to recruit a bunch of soldiers, young bravos, and they would come down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers and be met by Wilkinson with troops. There weren't only a few hundred American troops at the time in that area, but that would be plenty. It would be the most powerful military force there. They expected there to be an insurrection in New Orleans, which was populated largely by French-speaking people who didn't want to be part of the United States. The Louisiana Purchase had just closed a couple of years before. And they were very restless and unhappy, and that they would then invade Florida, which was held by Spain, and Texas and Mexico, and with luck, they could end up with a new American empire, which would then the western part of the United States might well choose to join because all of its commerce went through New Orleans. And whoever controlled New Orleans would really control the Mississippi and the Ohio Valley. So that was the most outrageous, audacious plan. Burr was a mix of audacious and cautious, so he had sort of sub outcomes that he might have to default to if he was not able to achieve the most outrageous part of the plan, you know, which might involve if Jefferson were finally to declare war on Spain, which Jefferson was close to, well, then Burr might try to get leadership of American troops and lead troops against Spain. He was looking for some way to do something extraordinary, and whatever way he could make it happen, he was going to try.
So it really was, in this case, for Burr personally, it wasn't like he had a philosophy that differed from Jefferson's to the extent that he wanted a different kind of government. He just wanted to be in charge of something important.
You know, I do think that's right. He recruited by saying that they would be liberating the people oppressed by the Spanish government, and so there was a veneer of idealism. And he certainly thought Jefferson was a weak president and needed to be more assertive in dealing with the Spaniards and the West. He told Westerners that they were being oppressed by people by the rest of the country, that they were being taken advantage of by the Atlantic states, as they were called at the time. But he did not really articulate some sort of greater psychic or emotional achievement or some greater idealistic outcome that would happen. It really was all about achieving glory.
Attorney and author David O. Stewart is my guest. His new book is called American Emperor, Aaron Burr's Challenge to Jefferson's America. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David O. Stewart, author of the new book American Emperor, Aaron Burr's Challenge to Jefferson's America. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. David, I guess it should not surprise anyone that this triple agent, James Wilkinson, was willing to sell Aaron Burr down the river. Did Wilkinson just read the writing on the wall, realize this was not going to go well, and then decide to let Jefferson know what was going on?
It seems that way. It seems we know that there was a moment in October of 1806 when he receives a letter from Burr. It basically says, I'm coming, I've got my men, it's time to go on to Mexico in glory. And Wilkinson did not react quickly. He seems to have thought about it for a few days. We have a couple of accounts of his behavior at the time. And then he sat down and wrote a report to Jefferson, much of which was false, but the gist of which was there's this terrible insurrection beginning out west, and you must stop it. Of course, Wilkinson was one of the ones who had been starting it, but he left that out. Then he rushed back to New Orleans to sweep up all of Burr's Confederates, and fortunately enough, since he'd been one of the Confederates, he knew who they were. A lot of Burr's friends afterwards were amazed that Burr had actually trusted Wilkinson. And considered that just an extraordinary mistake for a very smart man, Burr, to have made.
Barring Wilkinson's perfidy, I mean, did Aaron Burr ever have a shot at making his vision come true?
I think so. The Spanish presence in Florida and Texas was very weak. They had been sealed off. The mother country had, this was during the Napoleonic Wars, the Royal Navy had controlled the Atlantic for several years now and kept Spain from really exercising any real control. And Spain was weak. There wasn't much there to stop an American force. And had he been able to get the sort of force that he expected to get, he built boats to carry 1,500 men down the rivers. He ended up with only 100. But if he'd had 1,500, that certainly would have been enough to conquer Florida and might well have attracted a lot of other support, and which could well have given him enough to take after Texas and Mexico. So I do think he had a shot. He didn't have a chance if Wilkinson opposed him, and that is what happened.
Okay, so let's jump forward a bit here and talk about the trial of the 19th century, the treason trial of Aaron Burr. Thomas Jefferson just absolutely wanted this guy to hang, no question.
Yes, he wanted him to swing, you bet.
On the other hand, Chief Justice John Marshall, who was a distant cousin of Jefferson's, said, no, we have to follow due process here.
Yes, it's a real classic confrontation between executive branch, which is desperate for a conviction. Jefferson had been very slow to respond to the threat of Burr. He actually ignored warnings for 16 months. But once he was roused, he was quite vindictive, deeply involved in the prosecution. And Marshall was no admirer of Jefferson. They had been political adversaries, and Marshall considered Jefferson not a terribly good leader, frankly. And he was not going to allow the courts to be pushed around. John Marshall was our greatest Chief Justice for a lot of reasons, but one of them was he really established the independence of the courts for all time, I hope. And certainly in this instance, he made it quite clear that although the president, the highest officer in the land, desperately wanted this man convicted, that Aaron Burr was going to get the benefit of every legal or constitutional protection that he was entitled to. And there wasn't going to be any effort made to make it easy on the government. And in fact, Marshall made it very hard on the government.
How does the Constitution define treason?
Very carefully. The framers had been very anxious about treason. The kings of England had used the treason weapon to oppress their opponents. It is the only crime that's defined in the Constitution. It is defined as either giving aid and comfort to our enemy or levying war against the government. And you can only have a conviction if the defendant confesses or if there are two witnesses to an overt act achieving one of those two goals. So it's a very demanding standard, and that was on purpose. And we'd had a couple of treason prosecutions back in the 1790s, which didn't really follow the Constitution. They'd been much looser. They'd used really the old English law. And this was the first time that the constitutional provisions were really toughly applied by Chief Justice Marshall. And it was a tremendously powerful precedent that really prevented treason from becoming a terribly significant part of our legal landscape.
Who came to Burr's defense?
He was able to call on, of course, Jefferson's political adversaries, and the Federalists suddenly saw some virtue in Burr, or many of them did, and his longtime supporters. He was a man with a great many friends. His legal defense team had extraordinary talents on it. There were two former delegates to the Constitutional Convention, including Edmund Randolph of Virginia, Luther Martin from Maryland, two former attorneys general of the United States. Randolph had been one, as had been Charles Lee, was John Adams' attorney general. So he was able to command some support for him as a person. And it's important to remember when we look at the trial, too, that Byrd was extraordinarily successful in suppressing a lot of evidence. He was not a terrific insurrectionist, but he was a very good lawyer. And so he had said some very incriminating things to the British and Spanish ambassadors. Those were in diplomatic archives that remained sealed for generations. He and Wilkinson had exchanged letters that neither of them was willing to release. Today, you would have not have the choice whether or not to release them, but that was permitted. They were permitted to withhold them then. And his Confederates, who many of whom knew a good deal of what he had intended, refused to testify. One was offered a pardon in return for his testimony, and he refused the pardon, saying he had no reason to need a pardon, and then he refused to testify because it would incriminate him. Somewhat inconsistent positions, but that was allowed as well. So the trial itself did not really, much of what I can write about in the book was not available to the lawyers at the trial.
So he was acquitted at the treason trial, but then he was tried a second time.
Yes, he was also tried for violating the Neutrality Act, which was a statute that made it illegal for a private citizen to invade another country. It seems an obvious prohibition, but it was necessary in those times to stop things exactly like this, what Burr was trying. And he was acquitted there, too. And the reason he got acquitted was sort of it's the sort of thing only a lawyer could love. the prosecution wanted to bring the case in Virginia because they were afraid if they brought it out west, the Westerners would never convict because Westerners thought invading Spanish territory was a great idea and couldn't imagine it was a crime. So they brought him to Virginia, but in Virginia, they had to allege that something had happened in Virginia as part of this plan. The only thing that happened there was this muster of his followers on an island in the Ohio River, Blennerhassett Island, and Burr wasn't there.
Hmm.
So it was this technicality, in fact, or jurisdictional point that the case really went off on.
And in any case, had he been convicted, violating the Neutrality Act was a much lesser crime.
It was a misdemeanor. It would have just been a few months in prison. Jefferson was desperate to get anything, any conviction he could at that point. He kept writing his lead prosecutor that, you know, this would pour hot coals on the judges' heads, which plainly Jefferson himself wanted to do. To no avail.
You know, what I love about this book, David, is it is such a reminder of how fragile the fledgling United States was. At this point in our history, not every new American felt particularly tied to the Union. They weren't quite sure who they were and how their own existence was related to this country that had been formed. Can you talk a little bit more about the times in that respect?
Yeah, that's a great point. We had secession movements out west. The Westerners, again, really were oriented down the Mississippi towards New Orleans and not back across the mountains to the Atlantic states. And Burr was trying to convert that feeling into something in support of him. New Englanders considered secession. And even Jefferson wrote a couple of letters during this period saying, well, you know, if the Westerners secede, that's okay. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, and you know, and they will be as much our sons as will be the those in the Atlantic Confederacy. It's hard to imagine Barack Obama saying today, "Well, you know, if California wants to secede, well, whatever, that's okay." But that really was the tone, and there was not this sense of inevitability, and it was a conflicting thing. At some level, Americans wanted to occupy the whole continent. We, even as early as 1805, we're looking across to the Pacific. But then again, we're not so sure we want to stick together.
Hmm. Remarkably, Aaron Burr moved to England for several years after he was acquitted in both of these trials and sort of tried to get right back at it, planning this sort of insurrection, but had very little luck.
Yes, he proposed to the British government that they support him in an expedition down to South America to liberate the Spanish colonies. And I love this one piece. Is he finally signs up for Spanish lessons.
A useful skill.
Well, you think a little late in the game. The British, for political reasons, are not able to take him up on it and actually throw him out of the country. And he ends up in Paris, and he's trying to persuade Napoleon the same thing. Napoleon does think about it, but then decides against it for lots of good reasons, frankly. And Burr ends up stranded in Europe, really without a dime. He's living in a garret apartment and freezing to death, basically, until he finally can scratch together enough money to sneak back into the country in late 1812.
And there he lived for the rest of his days. Here he lived, I should say.
Yeah, he lived another 23 or so years. He ended up back in the practice of law. He was always a controversial figure, but he was a smart guy and a good lawyer. And, you know, he did cases with Daniel Webster and with Martin Van Buren and with some of the prominent lawyers of that day. You know, I think at some level that almost made his contemporaries even angrier. He managed to sort of put together a actual life despite all of his disasters.
Where does this leave you after all this investigation? Do you like Burr in a strange way? Was he just a disaster? Was he evil? What do you think about him?
Well, I don't think he's evil. He is a self-centered guy. You have to recognize that and acknowledge it. He's a wonderful company. It's something a biographer always worries about. You're going to spend a lot of time with this person. And Burr is always interesting. Mm-hmm. And when he was in his exile in Europe, he started keeping a diary. And suddenly this man of secrets lets us into his thinking. And he's a charming guy, and he's funny, and he's self-deprecating, and you begin to get a much better sense of why people liked him. And so it fills out the personality in a wonderful way. As a figure of history, you have to see him as, you know, a man who dared greatly. He's sort of Icarus, who dared greatly and failed greatly. It was an outrageous plan and scheme. You know, he came within he came very close to being hanged for it. So he expresses a lot about the American spirit. The sense of audacity, the sense of adventure. But, you know, his judgment turned out to be pretty flawed.
David O. Stewart is an attorney and author of the new book, American Emperor, Aaron Burr's Challenge to Jefferson's America. David, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.